The Guardian.
One, two, three. 开始。
Welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Jason Phipps. On the show this week,
I felt that something had to be done. No one else was doing the work in the way that I thought was appropriate, and so I decided I'd roll up my sleeves, document who was doing what, and try to shine some light on that mess.
The Guardian's technology editor, Charles Arthur, meets Harvard Business Professor Ben Edelman to discuss privacy policies, terms and conditions, and the best and worst practice when it comes to small print on the web. And
I do think that we're going to look back in 10 years' time and say, goodness me, you know, keys are outdated.
Hello, Jemima Kish here. Have you ever wanted to unlock your front door with your mobile phone? Well, a new app from One Fine Stay will allow you to do just that. I'll be talking to Greg Marsh, the chief executive and co-founder of One Fine Stay, about Sherlock.
And I'll have a tech news roundup for you, including MIT's newly revealed 3D computing interface and rumours that Google might be about to enter the music downloads market. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. The phrase terms and conditions for most of us triggers one fairly automatic reaction. Click. But wrapped up in this scroll of information is the fundamental relationship between online customers and providers of products and services. Ben Edelman is an associate professor at the Harvard Business School in the US and an expert in the scroll of information that follows the terms and conditions prompt. This week, he's been caught in a tussle with Google over the terms and conditions around app purchases in the Google Play Store. For Tech Weekly, The Guardian's technology editor, Charles Arthur, met up with Ben to find out more.
Ben, you're best known, if people do know your name, for the work that you've done regarding privacy. And especially to begin with, you got involved with a number of companies which were doing adware, which was installing on people's machines without their realizing it and was putting up adverts and earning a lot of money for the people who were doing that. Just tell us a bit about how you got into that and what sort of progress you were able to make there.
Well, the practices when I first began looking at that subject more than a decade ago were absolutely outrageous. These programs would install through security exploits, so you're just browsing the web. They'd take advantage of some defect in Windows or Internet Explorer or Java or what have you, and put software on your computer without your ever agreeing to it. Then they're tracking every web page you visit, showing extra pop-ups and pop-unders, sometimes taking you to one website when you request another, substituting these ads for those ads. Absolutely outrageous practices. I felt that something had to be done. No one else was doing the work in the way that I thought was appropriate, and so I decided I'd roll up my sleeves, document who was doing what, and try to shine some light on that mess.
And you did manage to shine a fair amount of light on what was going on with this, with the adware companies. What was the outcome, and how long did it take to get to an outcome?
Well, most of the adware companies, at least of that generation, did ultimately cease operations. Gator, Clario wanted to have a public offering, filed their SEC S-1, and then ultimately had to abandon it in response to public outcry. Ultimately, the company was liquidated and investors got pennies on the dollar.
What year was that?
Let's see, 2005, give or take, that it all came to an end. We should double check. But there are still adware companies floating around. There's a company called Sambreel, which makes such apps as PageRage. Probably your listeners don't have this, and that's for the best. They will go into legitimate publishers' websites, look for banner ad-sized elements, like a 728 by 90 or a 160 by 600, either replace those or put their own just above, typically pushing the genuine ads down. Absolutely outrageous. A publisher that toils to produce original content doesn't get the fruits of those efforts, and Sambreel, having done not much, just snuck onto a user's computer, all of a sudden probably makes more money than the publisher itself.
So after the adware companies got nailed, the FTC was, the Federal Trade Commission in the US, was pretty active in actually getting them to stop. And there were some very, very big multimillion $1,000 fines in a number of cases. What, I mean, you must have, did you feel, find yourself at a loose end, or did you suddenly realize that there was a whole world of privacy issues out there that needed tackling?
Well, other kinds of consumer protection issues started to come to the fore for me. I looked at deceptive banner ads, deceptive pay-per-click ads. If you go to Google, even today, and you type in Skype or PDF reader or Kazaa, God help you, you know, over the past few years, on the whole, there have been counterfeit versions of all of those apps, those genuine apps, but bundled with spyware and adware and other tricky software. They'll put some toolbars on your computer. There's plenty of badness out there in the world to keep me busy. If I ever want to write an article about bad practices that should be reformed, I certainly am not lacking for material.
And how do you mix this in with your work at Harvard Business School? I mean, does it overlap with what you're doing there? Is there sort of intense interest in at HBS with the whole issue of consumer protection and privacy?
You know, I'm fortunate in that the school supports what I'm doing. It's not a traditional subject of academic work, especially at a business school, but privacy is awfully important to business and to consumers. Consumer protection is awfully important to consumers and to legitimate businesses, the businesses that have to compete with sort of underhanded practices from their competitors. So there's plenty to be said for this work, and fortunately I have some more traditional scholarship also.
Do you think that it's getting worse? I mean, you know, the whole adware thing really was, to some extent, was almost out of control, it seemed, until some of the authorities started to get a handle on it. Do you think that in general, the whole issue of consumer privacy is improved, or has it actually got worse, and we're just not seeing it as well as we used to?
Well, the problem of adware has improved on the whole, but consumer privacy remains a very serious vulnerability. Indeed, there's more data being collected than ever. People are posting more pictures to Facebook, traveling with smartphones that collect data in ways that users didn't expect and maybe couldn't have expected because they weren't told. So there are plenty of privacy problems to go around.
And is there a sort of issue where people could say, well, okay, so I'm posting stuff to Facebook and, people can see that, but I sort of signed up for it because I went with Facebook. Or do you feel that there are more shades in the understanding that people don't quite have, that they find things going somewhere which they didn't perhaps understand fully, even though it's all there in the privacy policy? You know, and in fact, they find there's a little box down the bottom which was ticked for them already.
Well, certainly there can be deception of the sort you describe, but even Facebook, which would tell you they have excellent privacy settings and robust controls, I don't know, I'm a sophisticated user. I think about this, I check carefully before I post anything I'm at all concerned about, and wouldn't you know it, I've had my share of Facebook privacy problems, at least two that come to mind, where I posted something, vividly remember checking the box, and then lo and behold, it gets distributed in a way that I didn't intend. In one case, I even had a screenshot of myself having checked the box in a particular way, come back, and it's set in quite a different way. How can that even happen? One would like to be able to document it systematically and repeatedly if there were genuinely a defect in their software, but I'll leave it at this much. Even a serious, well-intentioned, careful expert user can still find themselves having trouble with this stuff.
Most recently, you've been critical of Google, the fact that its App Store, if people buy apps from Google Play, then the developer who sells the app gets access to the user's name, email address, and location data, such as it might be a zip code or a postcode in the UK or sort of a generalized area. Do you think that that's the same sort of overreach in terms of privacy, that Google's taking too much data there?
Certainly that's data that Google needs to have. In order to process your payment and process your credit card charge, Google needs to know your name. They're going to need to know your email address to send you a receipt and so forth. But the design of Google's App Store seems to anticipate and allow and even facilitate Google keeping this data confidential. Yes, you give Google your name, but there's no reason why the app developer needs to know your name. All the app developer has to do is provide an app that Google so diligently copies on to your phone. And that's the way it would seem. Indeed, there are other Google services like Google Checkout where Google proudly touts that kind of privacy protection. So we know Google's thinking about it. Meanwhile, you read the privacy policy for the Google Play purchase system, and it sure doesn't tell you that your name and email address and location are going to be sent to the developer. It says Google will share the information that's necessary, but it's far from necessary why your name is going to be delivered to the app developer. Quite the contrary, app developers typically didn't even know they were receiving this information. So why is Google providing it? Well, we've yet to get a satisfactory answer to that.
Is the problem that the whole privacy policy industry just leads to gigantic things which are pages and pages long where no one can really be bothered to A, read it, and B, understand it? Is there sort of any simple solution to that?
Well, you know, some companies have done better than others at making their privacy policies easy to understand. Google's policy isn't hard to understand. There are multiple policies. Sometimes they're inconsistent. But in this instance, they were all completely consistent. They all said that they wouldn't send this data, but then they did. When I look at privacy policies, what I'm most worried about is the absence of real accountability. You promise one thing, you do something else, and what then? In the ordinary course, we'd expect litigation to ensue. If I contracted to buy 2 kilograms of apples and I found some oranges mixed in, I'd go to the store and I'd say, look, it was supposed to be apples, not oranges. Give me my money back or give me the difference in price. But you can't do that when it comes to privacy. Most courts have been skeptical of privacy claims. Your privacy is worthless, or at least it doesn't have a value in any currency. As a result, you can't sue when your privacy is violated, and therefore the companies needn't worry too much if perhaps they sometimes fall short.
So what we need then is almost like a privacy economy, something where we can say, my privacy is worth this much, and you know, this sort of intrusion or this sort of breaking of it is therefore worth to me this much.
At least if a judge could say that. If a judge could say, I'm not sure what your privacy is worth, but it's worth at least £1 per person. So anyone who suffered this problem gets £1. Then every British user who had their name and email address taken by Google and delivered improperly would get £1. And that would add up to something. Millions of users, millions of purchases. That would be a deterrent. It would justify hiring a better lawyer and a better developer next time to get it right.
So just to sort of end on a positive note then, who are the companies who you think do privacy policies well? Who are the ones who actually stand out for you and where you think, you know, good tick for them, gold star?
Well, actually, I think Google's privacy policy is not terrible in terms of the way it's written. You can understand it. It's a question of following it, but the quality of writing is pretty good. I've been impressed by Amazon's privacy practices and also Amazon's description of its practices. They're very careful. They clearly worked hard, and so far as I know, they comply with it. One doesn't hear about this sort of problem at Amazon. Amazon's business is plenty complicated. They have lots of moving parts, but when Amazon says they're going to do it, typically they really deliver.
Ben Edelman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And to find out more about Ben Edelman's research, just go to his website. That's benedelman.org. This is the latest from the best technology news site on the web, guardian.co.uk/technology. The World Mobile Congress took place this week in Barcelona with an exciting range of new technology on display. Samsung stole most of the headlines by announcing that their new Google-powered Galaxy S4 smartphone will be launched next month. There was also excitement around the revealing of Sony's new answer to the iPad, the Xperia Tablet Z, which is waterproof and dust-resistant. Other innovative bits of tech include waterproof phones, glove-friendly touchscreens, and the announcement of Firefox's operating system, which aims to take on iOS and Android devices this year. Nokia also revealed their intention to capture a new market within the developing world, with a £13 scale-down smartphone featuring battery life that lasts for a month. Search giants Google are rumoured to be in negotiations with major music labels about launching a music streaming service similar to Spotify. Speaking exclusively to The Guardian this week, Francis Keeling, global head of digital business at Universal Music Group, claimed that the move would have a significantly beneficial impact on the industry. He said, Google, with its hundreds of millions of users through search, along with YouTube's 800 million users, is arguably the biggest funnel we could have. Clearly, if we could get consumers into a legal funnel through that route and encourage them to subscribe, that would have a very positive impact on the business. Google themselves, however, have declined to confirm the details of the streaming service, which is believed to be set for release in the third quarter of this year. It was revealed this week that over 20 European governments have been targeted by cybercriminals in a complex online assault seen rarely since the turn of the millennium. Dubbed Miniduke by researchers, the attack infected government computers as recently as this week in an attempt to steal geopolitical intelligence. The governments targeted include those of Ireland, Romania, Portugal, Belgium, and the Czech Republic. The cybersecurity firm who discovered the attack, Kaspersky Lab, claimed that the perpetrators had servers based in Turkey and Panama. Yet it is still unclear just what information the hackers were targeting and exactly who they were. The news follows the revelations last week that the Chinese were launching hundreds of cyber attacks on Western defence and media organisations. Also this week, a transparent computer that allows users to reach inside and touch digital content was unveiled at the TED conference in LA. The SpaceTop 3D desktop is the brainchild of MIT student Jinja Li, and he has been developing the product with Microsoft. The see-through device allows users to literally pick up files and flick them like a book, and could prove a revelation to architects and designers collaborating on 3D projects. Li, however, is most excited about the educational benefits that the device could provide to future generations of children. He said, "It could be used in schools. One of our key human skills is to be able to interact with 3D spaces, and I wanted to let people do the same with digital content. It makes the learning experience so much more powerful." The SpaceTop is still in its early stages of development, however, so don't expect to see it on shop floors for a while yet. Li hopes that the system will be coming into general use within a decade. All these stories and so much more can be found at guardian.co.uk/technology. Jemima Kish is up next, looking at the future of house keys with the new Sherlock app. But first, if you have too little time to read, why not let your ears do the walking with the free-to-download Guardian Audio Edition.
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, the Norwegian prison where inmates are treated like people. A day at Gladstone Primary, the school where they speak 20 languages. And in our audiobook review, we explore the world of work with Dave Egger's latest novel, A Hologram for the King, and Oliver James's examination of duplicity and double dealing, Office Politics. To subscribe for free to the Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud, iTunes and Audioboo. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture. Hello, I'm Jemima Kish. I'm talking today to Greg Marsh, who is co-founder and chief executive of One Fine Stay. Greg, you've just launched an interesting iPhone app, but your core business, just before we talk about Sherlock, is One Fine Stay. Is it fair to describe you as an upmarket Airbnb?
Yes and no. I think there are a host of internet businesses that have sort of broken onto the scene in the last few years that help people make more of what they've already got, whether that's making more of their car when they're not using it, or more of their house when they're not using it, or more of their power tools when they're not using them. Really, we're as much about that for people with nice homes in central cities as we are about making that process really easy. The challenge that many people with very nice homes in central cities have is they often have complicated, busy lives, and probably not the inclination or the time to manage those properties when they're away. One thing to say, if you want, for those people, is a full service or turnkey solution, which makes a lot of those management complexities, the hassles, the security risks and the complexities evaporate. They'll get their home back when they return, just like they left it, maybe a bit cleaner. Whereas guests who are coming into those cities and would otherwise, frankly, stay in a nice hotel, get to stay in a much more characterful and interesting space as an alternative to a hotel. So we think about ourselves much more as a next generation alternative to, a luxury hotel than we do as an internet business.
So explain Sherlock then. How does this fit into your core business of offering premium accommodation space? It seems a bit of a tangent to offer an iPhone app that opens your front door. Tell us more.
It's actually very much our business. You know, when we launched in 2010, just coming up to 3 years ago, we were managing half a dozen properties right in the centre of London, and that was that. And even then, juggling keys one way and another is always a risky business. You drop the wrong set or put the wrong set on the wrong hook, and suddenly you've got all sorts of trouble. So right from the start, we had to develop a fairly sophisticated system to manage, you know, now coming up to tens of thousands of sets of keys in London and New York. As time's gone on, the challenge associated with that key management only become more complex. And what we've heard again and again, not only from people in our team, we have about 150 people worldwide now supporting our operation in London and in New York City, but also from our members, is, you know, there must be an easier way. Rather than having all these keys floating around just to solve the problem that front doors stay closed until you've got a set of keys in your hand. And so we started looking fairly keenly on what else was on the market to support that problem, and we couldn't find anything. All the existing solutions out there fundamentally only solve one door. They don't solve two doors, and yet the vast majority of people who live in city centres have an apartment front door and also a building front door. And that building front door is often not controlled by the person who lives in that property. It's often controlled by a building management company. It's controlled by an independent business. It's controlled by a freeholder rather than the leaseholders. And changing the keys to that building front door, installing some whizzy electronic lock, etc., really isn't an option in the vast majority of cases. So Sherlock, put very simply, it's an iPhone app, certainly. It's also a service and a physical box. And that box is not installed in the common areas of the building. It doesn't interfere with your locks. It doesn't require you to change your keys. It's installed inside your apartment, just next to the entry phone that you already have in most cases. And it talks to the entry phone to tell it when to open the front door. So it doesn't actually involve making any changes to the building door. It simply makes use of the existing technology, the legacy technology systems in a building, to make it possible for you to access that property either without keys or when you're not otherwise at home.
This is a really good example of a problem that you've solved, because it's a problem that was a really big deal for you to sort out. Can you describe how this actually works? If I had my phone in my hand and I'm standing at my front door, what does it look like on my phone, and how does it work as I try to get into the building?
Yes, and the answer is it depends a bit. So the very simple use case would be you are the owner of the property, you're coming home, either you have your keys or you're juggling your keys or you don't have your keys. And at your front door, or shortly before you get to your front door, you open the app, you touch the unlock button, there's a swipe code, and then the building door, that's the first door you walk through, a moment later will buzz open. You'll push that door open. And as you're walking up the stairs to your flat front door, a few seconds later, the system will automatically send the open instruction to that door. So in practice, with that single button press, you've opened both of those doors and you've got access to your home. A slightly more elaborate use case, which is perhaps a better example of really why this is, in some senses, the beginning, I think, of a number of types of technology like this that will revolutionize the way we think about front doors to people's homes, is, you know, you're away from home and a delivery man comes. And rather than giving the delivery man access to your entire property, maybe you just give the delivery man access to the building front door and the hallway area so he can leave the parcel there or pick something up while you're away. And in that scenario, you know, maybe you get the buzz on your phone, you answer the buzz, and you just say, open the building door only, rather than open both the doors of my property. Of course, the other scenario is that I trust you. Maybe you are someone who's a friend of mine, maybe you're a tradesperson, and you want to access my property when I'm not there. I can give you, via text message, a one-time use virtual key. And when you turn up to my front door without a smartphone in your hand, just with a normal phone with just SMS, you reply to that SMS typing OPEN, you hit send, and again, a moment later, the front door will open because I've authorized that one-time key. So even phones that aren't so smart and people who I trust on a one-time use basis can access my home when I'm not in it.
So you've thought of every eventuality. I can see this is really going to appeal to people who want to have a wired home of the future. It's kind of one step further there. But how about security? What if somebody steals your phone? What if your battery dies on the way home? How do you resolve those kind of obvious, user problems?
I mean, theft is theft, and practice, if someone steals your keys, you're similarly exposed if they knew your address. I mean, clearly, if your address information is on your person or in your wallet and someone's stolen your handbag, then you've got the same challenge. The good news is, unlike losing a set of keys, if you were to be unfortunate to lose your phone, to have given away the PIN code to the app, and to have given away your address at the same time, all you'd have to do is call us and we'd simply turn off Sherlock and your phone would no longer be registered for use for your front door. So it's a bit like having a set of keys that you can deauthorize at any point by remote control. I think the other security issue, of course, is that keys are much less secure than you might imagine. We take it for granted that, you know, keys are physical things and therefore they're safe things. Unless you have laser-cut locks, keys are very easy to copy. And even if you have laser-cut locks, unless you have very modern laser-cut locks, even those can be copied if you find a bit of a dodgy locksmith. Most people, the average UK citizen, has more than 9 sets of keys in circulation for their house. And if you put a gun to my head and said, where are mine? I could tell you where about 5 sets were. I don't know where the other ones are, if I'm honest. There's probably some in a drawer upstairs somewhere. There's probably some I forgot to get back from the plumber. And so it goes on. So I'm not sure that we're starting with a perfectly secure Fort Knox and introducing an insecure system. I think in many ways, the ability to revoke access at any time, to grant access, the audit that you know who has accessed your front door and when, the fact that you can see that information, that you can grant that information over the web or on an iPhone app, in many ways, there's a dramatic improvement in security. And that's certainly what we've heard from the pilot customers that we've been working with in London.
Okay, good point. Good point and well made. So there are there's some hardware that is needed if people want to start using this system, and that must have represented a significant investment from you in setting this product up and researching it.
Yeah, a scary one, if I'm honest, because there's one thing which is, you know, bits and bytes and writing software, and that's sort of the world that I and my co-founders come from to some extent. The world of soldering irons and circuit boards is a very unfamiliar one, and that sort of investment can quickly get out of control and become very complex and expensive. We got a bit lucky. There's always a lot of luck involved. One of my co-founders' university friends, actually, is a very talented hardware engineer, and we were able to persuade him through a bit of arm twisting and lots of free pizza to spend some time with us and help us crack the early sort of design challenges that this represented. It has taken about 18 months of hard work. It's not just suddenly happened. Unlike an iPhone app, which you can build in your bedroom on your own, this is a fairly sophisticated bit of technology. It's patent pending. It's involved quite a lot of different design processes. It's involved third-party consultants to help us with the security systems and engineering. It's got quite a lot of proprietary bits in it. And we think this is just the beginning, but it's certainly been a steep learning curve for us, and we've got a lot more to get right.
So when and where can we get this app?
Yeah, we'll say real soon now. The app itself, as I say, is a portion of the solution. The physical box and the service, at the moment we're rolling out to One Fine Stay members in London. We'll be rolling that out to One Fine Stay members in New York, hopefully a little later this year. And I think based on the level of interest we've really heard from people in the last few days, I'd love to look at ways that we can make this more widely available. That may take us a little longer. There's a bit more work that we have to do on our side to make that possible. But fundamentally, I think this is a much broader set of challenges around getting access to your home when you're not in it. I do think that we're going to look back in 10 years' time and say, goodness me, you know, keys are outdated. Thank goodness we no longer rely on those. You have to wait at home for deliveries and have the inconvenience that implies. But we've got a lot of hard work to do to get there.
Next time I leave my house keys on the train, I will be thinking of you. Greg, thank you very much for your time and your thoughts.
Thanks.
Bye.
That's all we have for you this week. Tech Weekly was brought to you by the Guardian's technology team and produced by me, Jason Phipps, with the invaluable assistance of George O'Donnell. The music featured on this edition is by the wonderful UK artist Unseen Machine. To hear the tracks in full and to download for a modest fee, just go to his website, unseenmachine.com, or you can follow the link on our blog. But for now, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.